Donald Trump has torn up his ceasefire deal with Iran. The war is back on, or is it? Meanwhile, Russia may be at war for the first time in years. Remember, their invasion in Ukraine has been a, quote, special military operation, not a war. But over the last few days, that has changed, and they've started to say, well, maybe we might be at war after all. What does that mean? And NATO members held a major meeting in Turkey this week. Can that alliance last? Should it last? We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World.
Is the ceasefire over? Is the ceasefire done? Is the MOU dead?
It's a very interesting question. To me, I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people. And they're vicious, violent people. And if they had a nuclear weapon, they'd use it. As far as I'm concerned, it's over. I'll speak to our negotiators. They want to negotiate. They're good people. Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner. But they have to come back to me. As far as I'm concerned, it's just a waste of time dealing with them. They're liars. We make a deal. And they, if I make a deal with him, we have a deal, and he goes out, he talks. We make a deal. Everyone's agreed. No nuclear weapon. We make a deal. They go outside, talk to the press. They say, we never even talked about it. There's something wrong with them. They're cuckoo. As far as I'm concerned, it's over. We attacked very powerfully last night. The very dangerous people from Iran, they're sick. There's something wrong with them. We said, go and do your funeral stuff. And instead of that, they start shooting rockets at ships. And they're a bunch of scum. You want to know the truth? They're scum. And so we don't like them. I don't like them. And they're evil people. And it's the denuclearization of Iran. And we're going to denuke it. We're not going to let them because they're crazy. And they can't have a nuclear weapon. I don't like them at all. And frankly, I think we waste a lot of time with them. They're bad people, very bad people. I think they're incompetent, by the way. Because if they were competent, they would have made a deal a long time ago, like how about 47 years ago?
That was President Trump this week in Turkey, essentially saying the Iran deal, the memorandum of understanding, it's done, it's over, it's ripped up. I don't even want to talk to these guys anymore. What is the situation with the Iran war? Well, first, let's go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic. Mihailo, what led up to that dramatic statement that we heard there?
Well, the main thing is differing interpretations of that memorandum. There's one clause that the U.S. claims means status quo's back. We could sail through the Strait of Hormuz. Everything's good to go. Iran interprets that clause as, we have control over Hormuz now. That means anybody that tries to use Hormuz without our permission or uses America as its backer rather than us, they're fair game. We could fire missiles at them. It's not hard to see how these two interpretations would collapse into the open conflict we're seeing. Iran has been firing at ships on and off, merchant ships, more or less since the memorandum got into play. The other issue, of course, would be the nuclear talks themselves. Iran has been doing its characteristic dragging its feet, and it appears President Trump has finally lost patience, realizing they don't want a deal if he didn't realize that before, and is just trying to find some face-saving way of not looking like a total surrender to Iran. With that being said, as you wrote in today's morning brief, even though there's a war going on there, or the war technically has restarted, they're still talking.
Right. So, yeah, that's what went into what led up to Donald Trump's statement. So, yeah, so what exactly has followed from Donald Trump saying the Iran deal is torn up? Obviously, I think there's been some violence, but how widespread and how total is, or what has been the response to say, well, we don't want to talk to them anymore?
In a nutshell, bombing their military facilities that they've been using in the Strait of Hormuz, their missile sites, their launch pads, etc. It's not what it was when this war started in February. There's no bombing of Tehran. There's no assassination of senior figures. There's certainly no activity from Israel, which I think in and of itself is telling. If the war was actually restarting like it was before, Israel probably would have the green light to do whatever they want. But the fact that we haven't heard a peep suggests that there is still a lot of restraint, or the White House is putting a lot of pressure on Israel not to get involved, not to rock the boat of any other potential negotiations going on. President Trump has said his main goal is to get the status quo back in the Strait of Hormuz, so it seems as if the nuclear issue is not even on his radar anymore, or at least he's accepted it as a lost cause.
Now, this kind of blew up in a way out of nowhere, because I think this was entirely predictable. Iran responded exactly the way that all of us here expected Iran to respond. And you just don't quite know how Donald Trump is going to react to that. Given that, I think it's quite hard to predict the future. But where do you think we go from here, Mihailo? What is the next play? Is this back to full-scale war eventually, or what?
Well, I think Iran has learnt through this whole experience that as long as they stick to their guns, as long as they are intransigent, don't move one bit, eventually America runs out of patience. It runs out of ammunition. We've talked about that in this program before, and America hasn't replenished its stock since then. Eventually, the United States realizes that we just have to cut our losses and let Iran dictate to us the least bad terms it can do that. Again, the resumption of this war is a flicker compared to the fire that was going on several months earlier. I think Iran knows President Trump is vulnerable. He's looking for an off-ramp. He's looking for any kind of face-saving measure that could in some way paint this at least as a partial victory. And Iran wants to milk that out as much as possible for them to get the best concessions it possibly can. I don't think the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding are going away anytime soon. I think that's going to be the basis for whatever the final settlement is. Again, this is just a conflict of one clause in that memorandum. Everything else apparently has not been an issue to this point, at least from what we could tell publicly. And I think we're going to see the style of nuclear talks going on, the funding, the sanctions relief, once the dust settles, all of that is going to come back.
So, Andrew, looking at this from the United States, what's your perspective on this deal?
Well, it definitely just shows what a quagmire America's gotten itself into, and highlights the what we like to call the peace derangement syndrome of the Trump administration. I feel like Donald Trump in particular and his general administration is still treating the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, like they're reasonable people who, if we can just hash out the right terms, will get a lasting memorandum of understanding, and they might be hashing out over, okay, well, exactly how much of the Strait of Hormuz are you going to control, when the real cause of the problem here is the IRGC itself. Actually, it wasn't the current Middle East envoy. It was a former U.S. Middle East envoy. Dennis Ross came out this week and clarified that Donald Trump had been negotiating with some of the so-called more moderate elements in the Iranian government. And it was the Revolutionary Guard Corps that has kind of scuttled that deal and brought this back. And so I'm sure the U.S. will bomb them for a while longer, come back to the negotiating table, try to come up with better terms. But this is a problem that it's not an art of the deal issue, that like as soon as we get the perfect terms in place, everyone's going to be happy and we can just put this whole thing behind us. It is an issue where as long as the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is in power, this is going to be a constant thorn in America's side. The Strait of Hormuz, it's just really hard to underestimate just how important it is to Iran's global power. It's the biggest oil choke point in the world, and gives Iran tremendous power over global stock markets, global economics. A strait so important that, as we've brought up on this program before, is like pretty much the foundation of the dollar's global reserve currency status, is an agreement that the United States made with Saudi Arabia and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries in the 1970s, that as long as OPEC ensures that all oil traded internationally is traded in dollars, the U.S. will ensure that the free trade of oil through these strategic choke points remains free. The U.S. is doing a very bad job at that. Many nations are growing more concerned over whether the United States has the will to see the Strait of Hormuz made a free-flowing oil trade. And we know from Bible prophecy that they will not. Eventually, Daniel 11 tells us so that a European-led king of the north is going to come against the king of the south like a whirlwind. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has specified on several specific occasions that he feels that the king of the south's push against the king of the north is mainly going to involve two things: the city of Jerusalem and the oil trade. So if we know from prophecy that the king of the north is going to have to come in to basically secure Middle Eastern oil, stop the king of the south from using oil like a weapon, that America's not going to accomplish that. They haven't accomplished it so far. We're not willing to come in like a whirlwind, like the Bible says the king of the north will. We keep negotiating, and then this keeps problem just keeps coming back up and coming back up and coming back up. I feel like President Trump, one of his main concerns right now is, since this war is unpopular in the United States, Democrats don't support it, even many Republicans would like to see it put behind us. He definitely wants some sort of understanding, memorandum of understanding, before the midterm elections that are coming up soon. Even some Republicans in Congress are complaining that this is taking so long. So he doesn't have a lot of domestic support. So he's trying to wrap this up. But I think even he's looking at this pretty short-sighted. He's looking at this like mainly like a thorn that's going to hurt Republicans' chances in the midterms, which is an important factor to consider. But I think several orders of magnitude greater than that is, what is the effect of this going to be on the dollar's reserve currency status? Are nations going to continue buying oil in dollars if America doesn't hold up its end of the deal and make sure that these oil choke points around the world are free? Because if a nation like Saudi Arabia starts having to look to China or Europe or the UN or some other force to secure these straits, then they really have no need to trade oil and dollars like they have in the past.
Yeah, this is definitely a story that has a lot of wide-ranging ramifications, from America's alliance system, America's economic system, and then crucially what happens in the Middle East. Did you have anything to add to that, Mihailo, in terms of what we're watching here from a biblical prophetic perspective?
Well, the big one I would add would be several prophecies in places like Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, that specified if God's people Israel, which in this end time includes the United States, as the United States and Britain in prophecy brings out. If they rebel against him, if they rebel against his covenant, if they commit themselves to sin, God would curse them in a multitude of ways, and one of the ways is military defeat. Specifically, verses 19 and 20 of Leviticus 26 says that God would break the pride of Israel's power and their strength will be spent in vain. And you could definitely see that in Iran. America has on paper the world's strongest military, the most highly advanced technology. You've written about that technology and America's over-reliance on that before. And yet it cannot bring Iran to its knees. No matter what country America gets involved in, from North Korea, North Vietnam, decades back to now, nothing ever seems to work in its favor. And I think President Trump is, he probably doesn't realize that's what he's hitting against, but he's realizing he's hitting against something, an invisible wall stopping him from getting total victory, as he keeps saying he wants, and it's frustrating him, and he doesn't realize why, and that's why one of the big reasons he wants to back out of this. But until America repents of its sins, including trusting in God for victory rather than in its own strength, these disasters are just going to keep coming and coming, and add on to these effects, like, say, the dollar weakening that Andrew brought up, and so many other things as a result of these military failures.
I think another point that Mr. Stephen Flurry made on the Trumpet Daily Show is just the simple show in the title, that Mr. Gerald Flurry was right about Iran. That was the title of Wednesday's show, that we're seeing President Trump wake up to all of these things that Mr. Flurry wrote in the Trumpet print that we sent out, that he's been saying for a long, long time before that, that you can't negotiate with these terrorists. And it is just sad that he's recognized this, he's called them liars, he said they're irrational. We've gotten away from all the talk about, well, these are reasonable people, we've got new people in charge, we can do business with these people. We've gotten away from all of that. Yet still, despite that, the negotiations continue because, well, exactly as you said, Mihailo, because of America's broken will, what alternative is there? It's pretty much, it's negotiation or it's full-scale war. And America doesn't have the appetite for full-scale war. That would be hard. So negotiation failed. Let's just hope it continues. So many important prophecies here. It exposes America's broken will. You can see how this is teeing up the kind of financial crises that we've talked about. And then Mr. Flurry said for a long, long time that you're going to have Iran be the head of, or the leading this biblically prophesied power of the King of the South. They are already the head of the terrorist snake. We said right from the start of this, for this reason, that America wouldn't wipe out Iran. We can say that now that Donald Trump has come out and said, well, the deal's off, we're going back to war, we can say confidently he's still not going to completely take care of the problem. And I think we've seen that just in the days since, because he's ripped up the deal, but it's been a relatively low conflict warfare, and clearly he's still looking for a new deal. All right, I think while we've got the three of you, or the two of you, also the three of us together, we'll talk about NATO's Ankara summit in Turkey in just a moment. But before we get there, Mihailo, could you give us a rundown of just the other news from the Middle East this week?
Yes, this was a busy week. On July 6th, Hamas, in case if anybody has forgotten, they still exist. They're still against Israel in Gaza. They announced that they are dissolving their Gaza government and getting ready for a handover to President Trump's Board of Peace. What does this mean on the ground? Well, nothing much different. Hamas is still a terror organization. They still control pockets of Gaza. And according to sources speaking with the Jerusalem Post, they've set up a secret alternative government that will take over the administration of their parts of Gaza. They've already announced the civil servants aren't going anywhere, so-called. So that implies a government still functioning. It looks like, as we've talked before, Israel is tightening the screws in Gaza, taking more territory, and President Trump is letting them because he's tired of Hamas, just as he's tired of Iran. But Hamas is a smaller country, a little less leverage than what Iran has, so this may be their attempt to try and show President Trump they actually are committed to the peace deal, even though they have refused to lay down their arms at this point. Then on Monday, French President Emmanuel Macron made history by being the first major Western leader to visit Syria since the Assad regime fell in 2024, at the host of the new president, Ahmed al-Shara. That day, the two countries agreed to exchange ambassadors and sign various cooperation agreements. A French company will now be helping administer Damascus's international airport. Macron has indicated he wants to help Syria become a new nexus of global trade between the Eastern Mediterranean and the rest of the Middle East. Syria is a former French colony, and with a lot of other French colonies, like places like Lebanon, France still has a heavy influence. And President Macron may be trying to add Syria into that mix as well, which factors into a prophecy in Psalm 83 that we'll get into a little more detail when we actually talk about the Ankara summit. And then finally, a poll released by Israel's Channel 13 yesterday shows for Israel's election, the current front runner is Gadi Eisenkot, a former general and head of the chief of staff of the Israeli military, who just formed his party last year, doesn't have any seats in the Knesset, but he may be first in line to form a government. We haven't talked about him as much as, say, some other figures like Naftali Bennett, but between Eisenkot, between Bennett, it looks like many Israeli voters have their chance of finding somebody to replace Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu this autumn when elections are held, which could throw Israel into some more of the parliamentary chaos that has been characteristic, at least since before October 7th.
Thank you, Mihailo. Now, the other big story from the Middle East, it really overlaps between all three of our regions, the Middle East, Europe, the United States, was this big NATO summit that went on. We saw Donald Trump heading out to Ankara to meet with the other NATO states and draw quite close to have a lot of nice things to say about the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So maybe we'll go to Andrew to kick this one off. What stood out to you from President Trump's NATO summit in Turkey?
Yeah, I feel like his position on Turkey and America's alliances in general, like his position on the Iran war, has been very inconsistent. It wasn't long ago that he was talking about how he needed the memorandum of understanding because he thought that Turkey might intervene in the war on Iran's side. So actually talking about Turkey possibly being a U.S. enemy. And then so for him to go from that position that like, oh, well, we need to watch out for Turkey. They might be willing to fight against America for Iran to this Ankara summit where he's just basically really lauding Turkey as an ally. I think it definitely highlights the same sort of peace derangement syndrome we're seeing with the Iran war negotiations, where you just vacillate back and forth between Iran's our enemy, Iran's a nuclear bomb, Iran's the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism, Iran's a threat to world peace, to, oh, the moderates are getting control, we're going to make a memorandum of understanding, and back again. Similar with Turkey. It's like Turkey's a threat, Turkey might intervene on the side of Iran, to where actually, no, we've got like a really great alliance with Turkey, we need to establish this lover's relationship with a power that he recognized not even long ago was an enemy. So that's a big story that came out of the Ankara summit to me. The other big one, I think, as well, we're on the topic of just U.S. tension over strategic sea gates around the world. Because NATO has been so unsupportive of President Trump's attempts to secure Hormuz. He's said many times before that he feels like we'd be there for NATO, but NATO wouldn't be there for us. In this conflict, NATO definitely has not been there for us. So he highlighted a fact that might be true, but is probably the wrong setting to say it. the fact that he really feels like the United States needs some measure of control over Greenland, just because of the strategic nature of that island being located in a place where Russian and Chinese submarines go through. This was something that he talked about several months ago that really created a huge diplomatic crisis between the European Union and NATO. I even wrote an article for the Trump at the time called The End of NATO. And so these comments over Greenland, it's reopened that wound, prompted comments from the Prime Minister of Denmark about how the Danes will fight for every square inch of Greenland. And I think just overall highlighted how the fact that NATO is, for all practical terms, a dead alliance. And you're not going to get much NATO help securing the Strait of Hormuz, which is probably why he's trying to reach out to Turkey, which he's said is an enemy before. So, the whole thing just really shows the disarray that America's alliances are in at the moment.
Yeah, the contrast between the way he treated Erdogan and the way he treated the rest of the NATO members was pretty stark. I think it's... You see this so much about Donald Trump, where if it's Vladimir Putin or if it's Erdogan, if it's some of these pretty unpleasant, evil leaders in many ways, he will have a lot of very nice things to say about them. And anyone who's listened to the show will know I am not the biggest fan of people like Mark Carney and Keir Starmer. But they do lead countries that are US allies. And for these, he can be very insulting in a way that he wouldn't be with, say, someone like Putin. And, he insults America's allies while being very nice to those enemies. And I think it was almost a funny situation flying out to this NATO summit, where it was President Trump in a room with a bunch of people that he'd been making fun of very recently. So he'd ridiculed Giorgia Meloni. There's been a big back and forth there. And he posted a meme saying that he needed to take out a restraining order against her. He's made fun of Emmanuel Macron, called Sir Keir Starmer, no Winston Churchill. I mean, no argument here. Jokingly referred to Canada's prime minister as a governor. Canada's not a real country is the implication there. Even Benjamin Netanyahu, he said, well, he knows who's boss. I like the point that Mr. Hilliker made earlier in the week in our weekly newsletter, which you can sign up for online, The Trumpet Brief. We try to send that out fairly early on in the morning with the most important news of the day. And he contrasted this with President Trump's apparent desire to be a man of peace and to win the Nobel Peace Prize and all of these ambitions. He said that such unprovoked and unhelpful slights seem increasingly common. A man who keeps score and can't resist reminding everybody in the room who's in charge is not practicing peace. The subject of peace, peace between individuals, peace between nations, it's the same issue. Mr. Hilliker said, what is remarkable is how often that Donald Trump flouts every personal aspect of peacemaking. Real peacemaking starts small with ordinary respect, treating people the way you want to be treated. Now, I do think, I think there is a breath of fresh air about Donald Trump's honesty, his sense of humor. Like, it is nice to have a world leader who is a real person. So... it is good, I think, that we've gotten away from some of this. Every statement is highly crafted and passed through a committee, and he is a leader. So there's some positives there, but I think what just fundamentally doesn't make sense is this idea of Europe, we want you to rearm, and Europe, we're going to insult you continually. Europe is weak right now. They are not going to stay that way. And that is also what was on display with this NATO summit, with Donald Trump going in there. And this was an opportunity to really encourage Europe to rearm. And again, I completely agree that Europe has been freeloading on the United States. And I completely agree that Europe needs to and should show much more gratitude for what America has done for it. I have an article in the special edition on America's 250th anniversary on how the world should be more grateful to what America has done. You know, no argument from me on any of that. And he's right that America has unfairly shouldered a lot of the burden. But the solution is not, hey, Europe, you really need to rearm, and also we're going to insult you. Because this is encouraging this new Holy Roman Empire that the Bible prophesies that is going to rise up and is ultimately going to attack America. And this is what we saw throughout the NATO summit, the lead up during the summit, after the summit. So we got news this week that Germany is going to borrow over $200 billion over the course of the next year. And on the final year of their previous government, they were only going to borrow about $60 billion. Why this massive increase? Well, a big part of that reason is defense spending. And it's no coincidence that they made this announcement about this borrowing ahead of the NATO summit. They wanted to send out this message, we're doing everything that we can. Yet ahead of the summit, Donald Trump posted on Truth Social, the United States spends more money on NATO than any other country by far to protect them, and it's true. And then he complained that Germany's defense spending was much lower than America's from 2014 to 2025. He's right, they're not upholding their share of the burden, but Germany's doubled its defense budget within 4 years, and those comments from President Trump seem to say that's not enough. We need even more defense spending from Germany. We need Germany to become even more of a military superpower. We also saw NATO announce this week about $50 billion in new procurement as part of this attempt to have long-range precision strike systems, $40 billion in counter-drone capabilities. These are several nations coming together to work on these. Also, since the summit, we've seen Germany come out and say, well, they're going to buy American Tomahawk missiles. And the thinking here is right now, America stations or has stationed Tomahawk missiles in Germany. Now Germany is going to buy the Tomahawk missiles. From Donald Trump's perspective, given the Trump administration, they're welcoming this. This is fantastic. This is exactly what they want. American taxpayers were spending money to put American missiles in Germany. Now Germany is buying the missiles and putting them in Germany. So the American taxpayer doesn't fit the bill. Fantastic. On that purely profit and loss calculus. But it means that Germany owns those Tomahawk missiles. Germany can point them where they want them to be pointed. They're not American Tomahawk missiles anymore. This is all about trusting Germany. Also, as part of the run-up to this NATO summit, you saw Canada come along and announce that they were going to buy 12 attack submarines from a German-Norwegian consortium led by ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. So Canada's also under pressure to spend more on their military. What are they doing as they spend more on their military? They're signing a massive deal with Germany. It's the largest military procurement in Canada's history. They haven't announced a figure. Experts are guesstimating $70 billion. And it's bringing German submarines to the North Atlantic. It's meant to create about 100,000 jobs throughout Canada. Under a lot of... There's a lot of people saying, well, actually, South Korea had a better offering. They had a submarine type that had already been built and tested. The ThyssenKrupp systems haven't made one of theirs yet, but Canada wanted to empower Germany. And then again, in the run-up to this summit, you had Lithuania's politicians getting together last week saying, well, we need to change the constitution so that we can have nuclear weapons in the country and so that we can have foreign military bases, which, if you're really sharp on your memory there, you might be thinking, hang on a minute, didn't Germany already create its first permanent overseas military base in Lithuania? Yes, they did, but their constitution bans foreign military bases. So they want to update that constitution. So Europe really coming together and Europe being empowered. This is exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong warned about for decades. Here's just a powerful clip from his World Tomorrow program on this.
Not the ancient Babylon, not the Babylon of 600 years before Christ, but the Babylon of our day now that is rising up, this thing that is soon to come, this thing that is going to dumbfound the people of the world. I want to tell you, my friends, the politicians of the great nations that are actually helping to build this thing and don't realize that they're only building a Frankenstein that is going to turn on us. They're going to stand aghast when this thing happens. Your Bible says so. It's in the prophecies of Revelation 17, verse 8. The nations will wonder, all whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold this thing. It's coming. It's real. You're going to see it. You don't believe it now. I know most of you don't. Well, you just stick it back in the corner of your memory somewhere, and when it happens, then I think you'll believe it. You don't have to believe it now, but it's going to be mighty important, and you better remember. And you'll believe it when it happens.
It's a wonderful, bold clip from Mr. Armstrong there. And it is all happening before our eyes. We are creating this Frankenstein monster. And the Ankara Summit this week was another milestone in this monster's creation. So watching it from the European perspective, seeing the Holy Roman Empire come together, these 10 kings that are talked about in Revelation chapter 17, this was one of the big things that stood out to me. Mihailo, let's bring you in now for the kind of the perspective from the Middle East of what we saw going on at this meeting.
Well, I think it ties in actually quite well what you were talking about with trusting, with opening up significant trust to these countries America shouldn't be trusting. A couple of bombshell announcements regarding America's and Turkey's relationship. President Trump announced that he's removing all military sanctions on Turkey. And President Erdogan said that they're in talks to buy the F-35 jets. Why is America putting military sanctions on supposedly a strong NATO ally in the first place? Well, years ago, Turkey bought a Russian air defense system. It's already integrated into their whole defense complex, and there were concerns if we sell American kit to this country that is integrated with Russia systems, that could give Russia a back door into spying on us. It could allow, say, cyber attacks to happen. And so we're going to be punishing Turkey until they start acting like a good NATO ally. Turkey hasn't changed its position one bit from when those sanctions were originally put in the first Trump administration. And President Trump just assumes everything's still good to go and goes ahead with removing them anyway, even giving one of America's most powerful tools, the F-35 jet. Basically told President Trump on public American television, Prime Minister Netanyahu did, I mean, don't do this. This is not a good move. We don't like this. And he went ahead with it anyway. Turkey has definitely earned its place as an untrustworthy country, as Andrew mentioned. There's even some talk of it joining Iran in the war. And the fact that America is trusting Turkey with so many sensitive deals like this, well, it gives Turkey, never mind Russia, it gives Turkey itself a backdoor to hurt America if it wanted to. And there's two prophecies in particular that tie in with this. Psalm 83, I mentioned earlier, it talks about an end-time group of Middle Eastern nations attacking the nations of Israel, including the United States, to the point where they want the name of Israel to be no more in remembrance. That's in verse 4. And Edom, or the ancestral people of the Turks, is mentioned in verse 6 about taking crafty counsel, about secret backroom dealings to attack the nations of Israel. Opening up to Turkey in this way certainly provides some kind of opening for this to be fulfilled. Our Mr. Fleury's book, The King of the South, explains more of that in detail. Meanwhile, the prophecy in the book of Obadiah, which is all about Edom, which is all about modern Turkey on the physical level, it mentions that Turkey will play a special role in betraying the nations of Israel, a very prominent and cruel role. And Mr. Fleury had an article last year in the print edition called Turkey is Going to Betray America that goes into details about those prophecies.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. Let's go back to Andrew then for a rundown of the rest of the important news from the English-speaking world this week.
Yeah, a couple other significant news stories that relate to the trends we've been talking about. We were talking a little bit about the Iranian threat to Hormuz being a threat to the petrodollar. We actually had a former comptroller of the United States issue a warning this week about how America's $40 trillion debt is an existential threat. This debt level is now equivalent to 123% of America's entire gross domestic product. And it's growing 2 to 3 times faster than the U.S. economy is. So you could argue that if the debt and the economy were growing at the same speed, you could kind of maintain the status quo. But with the national debt growing at 2 to 3 times the economy, a bigger and bigger portion of America's tax revenue has to go to interest. And eventually, there's some debate over exactly when, but eventually, at some point in the next few decades, it is going to lead to American bankruptcy. So this is a former comptroller of the currency, worked under both the Bill Clinton and the George W. Bush administrations, warning America that it needs to make a U-turn financially to avoid its overall destruction. And then we see nothing of that sort happening, which is going to make things so much worse when crises over areas like Hormuz threaten the dollar's reserve currency status. Then another topic, back on the topic of there just not being a ton of domestic support for Donald Trump's attempts to deal with the Iranian threat. We've got a rising democratic socialist movement in America, and even a pretty shocking poll finding that the Muslim socialist mayor of New York City, Zohran Mamdani, is actually more popular amongst American Jews than Benjamin Netanyahu is, showing that something like 40%, I think 41% of American Jews polled say that they support Zohran Mamdani and the Democratic Socialist Movement, compared to only about 30% say that they basically support Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts to keep the state of Israel from being wiped off the map. So, yeah, sobering poll showing, well, just how divided the Jewish people are, and then these particular Jews being American Jews, how divided the American population overall is towards this war in Iran. And then one minor third story along the same lines, this one from another one of the English-speaking nations, Great Britain, showing how divided their population is, showing that I believe for the first time in their history, hopefully for the first time in their history, Mohammed is the most popular baby's name.
It's the third year running. It's the third year running, not the first time in history, sorry. And even for many years before that, it was the first, if you combine the different spellings. I think it was 3 years ago it became the first time you didn't need to combine the different spellings for it to be the first one.
Yeah, I guess that's a continuing trend, though. That's something that would have been still shocking even a generation ago. But yeah, this I feel like it kind of goes along with like the 40% of American Jews actually support a Muslim socialist more than the Prime Minister of Israel, as you've actually got now in Great Britain amongst like the new generation. The most popular name is an Islamic name, which goes a long way toward showing what even Islamic policies, even like Sharia law in some cases, are becoming more and more popular in the British Isles.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. That brings us now to Asia, the last portion of the show, but I think this is still a really important story. It only really ended up at the back of the show just because everything else that we're talking about kind of involved all three of us that were on here earlier, and we're sitting down and talking about these things together. And that is the change in language over Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. I've seen some pretty respectable analysts say, well, this could portend something very serious for Russia, for Ukraine, for the world. So to give us this story, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. Russia's war on Ukraine for years, Vladimir Putin insisted that it was not a war. He called it a special military operation and required his fellow Russians to do the same. In the early weeks of this war, Putin's regime actually issued a manual to media outlets and educators across Russia, explaining that the nation was, quote, not at war with Ukraine, but waging a noble campaign to protect people who had been subjected to bullying and genocide. End quote. So Putin was very serious, and he even passed a law making it illegal to call the war a war or to otherwise discuss it in terms that contradicted his narrative, and it was punishable by 15 years in prison. And many Russians actually did go to prison for failing to comply. So it was a very serious thing. But on Sunday of this week, Putin shattered the taboo and broke his own law. This was actually Putin's official spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He gave an interview saying, quote, "There is a war going on. This is a real war. It all started as a special military operation. It continues like a war because Berlin, Paris, The Hague, Oslo, and unfortunately Washington are behind Kyiv." End quote. So there it is. And on the surface, this may seem insignificant, you know, whatever you want to call it. The missiles still fly, the drones still strike, and the cities are still getting pummeled. But when you consider just how serious it was for years to avoid calling it a war, and when you consider that Dmitry Peskov is no off-the-cuff commentator, but the man who gives voice to the Kremlin's official position and to Putin's official position, when you consider all that, then you see that this is quite significant. Putin knew exactly what his spokesman was saying, and he also made sure that this statement was widely disseminated by the Russian media. So Putin was sending a very clear message, and he was sending it to Europe. At the time of this rhetorical upgrade, Europe's leaders were heading to Turkey for the big NATO summit there. And the discussions in Turkey centered largely on Ukraine and on Europe's plan to establish new military aid packages for the Ukrainians. So Putin hoped that by saying Europe's decision to back Ukraine meant the continent had turned the conflict into a real war, he hoped that by saying that, that some European leaders would rethink their support of Ukraine. Russian security affairs expert Mark Galeotti wrote about this on Wednesday, saying, "By invoking the term war, the Kremlin is hoping not only to get Russians to rally around the flag, but also to make even the most determined European countries think again." End quote. Now, in the end, the Europeans did move ahead with their plan to establish that package of military aid for Ukraine, but that doesn't mean that Putin's talk of them being in a real war with Russia didn't get their attention and rattle many of them. George Friedman of Geopolitical Futures, he said that Europe sees this rhetorical shift as a sign that Putin could be preparing to escalate the war, perhaps even with the use of nuclear weapons. Other analysts have said that this change of language likely means Putin is preparing for a full military mobilization. And then we also have to keep in mind that this upgraded language comes as Russia is increasingly antagonizing Europe with drone incursions, GPS jamming, relentless hacks on government systems. All of that is becoming routine. Galeotti wrote about all this, saying, "In and of themselves, none of these are of critical importance. However, in conjunction with alarmist Russian rhetoric, Moscow's hope is that they create a sense of impending crisis." End quote. So there it is. Putin wants the Europeans to feel a sense of impending crisis. And judging by the way European nations today are coming together as never before and carrying out a historic military buildup, it is clear that Putin is succeeding in making them feel that way. Europe is deeply fearful of everything that Russia's doing. And this is a development that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry warned would happen for more than two decades based on biblical prophecy. Mr. Flurry has long said that Europe's fear of Russia would be a major driver of the continent's unification and militarization. And now we can see it happening in the headlines basically every week. And as Russia's belligerence continues, including with a possible escalation in this conflict that Putin is finally calling a war, we should expect Europe's fear to keep on intensifying and for Europe to keep on investing more and more into its firepower. And the scriptures show that that firepower will one day be unleashed on the world with breathtaking intensity. And if any listeners would like to understand more about that and about the prophecies that Mr. Flurry's analysis is built on, I hope that you'll check out his article, Russia's War on Ukraine is Reshaping Europe.
Thanks for that, Jeremiah. And I'm curious, do you think there will be more follow-up potentially on this? Like, obviously, it seemed designed, like you said, designed to kind of scare Europe into not taking some of the steps that they subsequently took in Ankara. I think, was it last week on the show, you talked to us about the possibility that Russia might invade you, or that Belarus might be kind of strong-armed into coming into the war on Russia's side. I mean, do you think we could still see over the next few days or weeks a pretty substantial change in this conflict?
I'm reluctant to put it on any sort of a timetable at this point, but when you look at everything that Russia is suffering right now with these just relentless assaults on its energy infrastructure, its refining capacity now has been reduced by something like 40%. You've got fuel shortages across the nation. Ukraine this week has even started to go after Russia's shadow fleet, all of these ships that allow it to evade sanctions and to illegally, you know, send oil around the world to countries like China and India. I don't think that this is sustainable for Russia. Most analysts think that Putin is in a very tight spot right now, and he doesn't want to surrender. He knows that his career, even his life, could be on the line if he were to back down. So that leaves him only with the option of somehow turning the war around. And yes, I think Belarus could come into play. I think there's a possibility that tactical nuclear weapons that have so far not been used could come into play. Perhaps Putin could convince China to more directly get involved in the war. We could also see Putin declare martial law and perhaps fully mobilize Russia, which could change things considerably on the battlefields there. So who knows if it'll be days or weeks or months, but the current, you know, the status quo right now, it's not sustainable for the Russians.
Well, that's a pretty sobering warning, but thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Like you say, exactly something that Mr. Flurry's pointed at for a long time. What else do you have for us from the Asia region?
Yes, first up, a quick one here about Russia and China practicing war together. Naval forces from the two nations launched a set of war games on Monday called Sea Interaction 2026. This is taking place in the Yellow Sea, and they are specifically practicing air defense, anti-submarine measures, and artillery firing. So it's just more evidence that Russia and China are actively preparing for a time in the near future when they will be making war together as allies. And then one final story here about India emerging as more and more of a powerful nation. And this week, they specifically took on more weight as a weapons exporter. The Indians agreed to sell Indonesia some of their BrahMos supersonic cruise missiles and also some Astra air-to-air missiles. So some very formidable weapon systems here. And this follows some similar deals that India has recently made with the Philippines and Vietnam. And these are all, you know, multi-million dollar, extremely powerful weapons that we're talking about here. So it shows that India is growing more and more influential with several Asian nations, and its military power is expanding.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah, for that update. Thank you to all of you for joining us this week with so much of what we talked about this week coming from the Middle East. The booklet I'll recommend to you as we wrap up this show is The King of the South. We would love for you to dig in and prove what we're saying to get one of our free booklets, to read it online, to turn to the scriptures in your Bible, to not take our word for it and see, yeah, this is what the Bible says about Iran. And I can prove to myself that this is talking about these modern nations. And that book there that has a chapter on the Psalm 83 Alliance that talks about Turkey betraying Israel and America. It has a section in there about Europe making alliances with the Middle East and coming in and basically replacing an America with a broken will as the ally for a whole lot of these countries. And of course, there's a lot in there to say about Iran. And it puts all of that in the context of Bible prophecy and in the context of the good news in the Bible and the return of Jesus Christ, and shows how all of these events are just so tightly bound up with that overarching prophecy. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to send that to you. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us. Trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com is the email address. Thank you so much to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We'll be back next week. Until then, keep watching your world.